morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We're live for a half hour each weekday morning to take your calls. If you have questions related to the Bible or the Christian life or the Christian faith, or if you have a different opinion from the host and would like to balance comment, feel free to call me in the coming half hour. We have a line open right now at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller today is Audrey calling from Buena Vista, Colorado. Audrey, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. We have a friend in the local prison who is very concerned about what he should do when he gets out regarding observing the Sabbath. He said, why is it that we observe all the other Ten Commandments, but we are we're rather ignoring that one and observing and worshiping on Sunday?
Well, the Ten Commandments are not presented anywhere in the New Testament as the body of legislation that defines Christian conduct. The definition of Christian conduct is obeying what Jesus said. Jesus said in John 8:31, if you continue in my words, then you are my disciples indeed. So a Christian or a disciple of Jesus is one who continues in what Jesus said in his words. Now, Jesus didn't actually ever teach that people should observe the Sabbath. And for that reason, it is my opinion that it's not a Christian obligation.
All right.
The Ten Commandments were actually the legal code associated with the Old Covenant, which God made at Mount Sinai. And that covenant has passed because a new covenant has taken its place. That's what it says in Hebrews 8:13, that where there's a new covenant, the old covenant has become obsolete. So, you know, although it appears that we keep nine out of the Ten Commandments, we really aren't keeping the Ten Commandments. We're not keeping nine of the Ten Commandments. We're keeping the words of Christ. When Jesus tells us not to steal, of course, we don't steal. When he tells us not to covet, we don't covet. Now, that looks similar to what the Jews were told to do in the Ten Commandments. But the Ten Commandments were specifically the stipulations for the Old Covenant. And what Jesus taught is the description of what's mandatory under the New Covenant.
Okay, and thank you. And also, there might be the argument that the important thing is that we do set aside a day of worship and rest, just as God rested. And so the day of the week that we do that isn't that important, but the way we spend it.
Well, when we say it's important that we set one day aside, I guess the question is important from in what context? Is it important for our health? It might be good for our health to set a day aside. And many people say that it is a very healthy thing to work 6 days and rest one day. And of course, the health benefits would be the same whether that was, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or whatever day. Now, if we say it's important in the sight of God that we set aside a day, I'm not sure that we have any New Testament authority to say that.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much. This has helped.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call. Good
Bye
talking
now.
To you. Bye now. Okay. Our next caller, also from Colorado, Tom from Colorado Springs. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hey, first of all, I would like to thank you for your commentary on the Book of Revelation. I forget the name of it right now. What is it? But I do have.
It's called copy. Revelation. Called Revelation Four Views, a parallel commentary.
Yeah. Well, and then the Four Views is the amazingly helpful part of that. Is that the way you so fairly present each of the several different views on the interpretation of the Book of Revelation? It's just a tremendous.
Well,
I haven't seen anything like it. So I really do. Do appreciate you having written that. As I don't see anything else, I haven't seen anything else like it. To tell you the truth, I don't think it's
And you won't. I did not want to write that book. I was actually looking for that book in print for 10 years, and nothing like it exists. So I ended up feeling there was a gap in the literature, and I wrote it.
Yeah, it's still in print.
Oh yeah, it's still in print. It's been in print since 1997. Thomas Nelson. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the question is regards Genesis 9. Like verses 26 and 27.
Uh-huh.
It appears to me this bit, obviously it's been a perplexing set of verses for others besides me. I understand it, the rabbis too. But first of all, it seems like kind of like a riddle, truthfully. It seems to be something of a riddle to me. But it seems to me to be kind of a messianic prophecy, actually, of God.
Well, I think it is. I think it is. I mean, I think that's a typical Christian way of understanding it. Noah, after his son has sinned against him, pronounces a curse on his grandson Canaan, but he also pronounces blessings on Shem and Japheth. Now, Shem and Japheth were his two sons who had been virtuous in this situation. And in Genesis 9:26, he says, "Blessed be the Lord, that is Yahweh, the God of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant." Now, it's interesting that of his three sons, Noah associated Yahweh with Shem. And that's rather interesting because Shem, all of the nations of the world came from these three boys. But Israel, among others, came from Shem.
Yes.
And so God is here associated with Israel, apparently. And it says, "And may God enlarge Japheth, and may he dwell in the tents of Shem, and may Canaan be his servant."
Now, who is
now,
he?
Japheth?
Well, Japheth was... Could he be God who dwells in the tents of Shem?
Well, it's possible. It's possible that God could be the one.
A prophecy of the incarnation. If that was the case.
Well, that'd be an interesting possibility. Actually, I've never heard that exact suggestion, that the God enlarging Japheth and God may dwell in the tents of Shem. We know that Jesus is God. The Word dwelt and tabernacled among us in Christ. I suppose it is a possibility. I don't think it's the most natural reading of the verse, but I guess I wouldn't rule that out. As I understand it, what he's saying is that God will enlarge Japheth, and Japheth will dwell in the tents of Shem. And there are references in Isaiah to this, how that the Japhethites are largely the Europeans and the Asian peoples. Although some people say some of the Asian people came from Shem. It's not entirely clear. It depends on which Asian group we talk about. But certainly the Europeans are from Japheth. And to say that they would dwell in the tents of Shem, well, Yahweh has already been associated with Shem in the earlier portion. So it sounds like it's saying that, the people of Japheth would come under the big umbrella associated with Shem, associated with Israel. And that would seem to speak of Gentiles coming into the church.
Yeah.
And the Bible in Isaiah tells Israel to expand the cords and the curtains of their tent to include the Gentiles in a couple of places. So I think
the only problem I have with that is the only problem I have with that possibility, and I think it's totally I understand that possibility, but I did a little graduate work in history, did kind of extended paper on abolitionism, and am aware that the second portion of that, verse 27, was used to justify, in the South, to justify slavery, that Canaan shall be
his servant. Well, how so?
Meaning Japheth.
How so?
Well, that Canaan, the African, is to be servant of Japheth.
Canaan
well,
that, is
I
not
mean,
an
I,
African.
I'm not saying that. I don't think so.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that
was
used.
See. Okay, well, first of all, what I said doesn't have any relevance to the subject of slavery. What I said is that the people of Europe, to a large degree, have come under the tents of Shem, that is, into the
okay.
into the family that was the Jews first. The gospel, for the most part, spread throughout Europe, and Europe became Christianized in a very early period of time. And I think that that's a good possibility that that's what that's referring to. But that wouldn't have anything to say about slavery. Excuse me.
Well, the second portion says, "And Canaan shall be his servant." Now, whoever he is, if he is God, then Canaan, then it's a prophecy of the spread of the gospel. If he is Japheth, then that's where they talk about him being the Canaan.
Well,
the African.
Okay, but here's the thing: the Canaanites never did become servants of Yahweh. They were wiped out by Joshua and the Israelites, and they were worshippers of Moloch and of Baal. So Canaan never became the servant of Yahweh. Maybe a few Canaanites did, like Rahab, who converted. But the Canaanites were not Africans.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. The Canaanites were the inhabitants of the Middle East, of the land of Canaan, of Palestine, before the Israelites conquered it. So that's not in Africa. That's in the Middle East. All right. I appreciate your call. Thanks for your input. Let's talk to Bernard from San Diego next. Bernard, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning, Steve. I really enjoy your program. My question is the Dalai Lama is in San Diego today and tomorrow, and he's going to be speaking at three universities, including the Catholic University down here in San Diego in front of a huge crowd. And I just wanted to get your take on a so-called Christian university allowing somebody like that to speak. And also, if you have a little bit of background on who the Dalai Lama is and what he stands for.
Well, the Dalai Lama is the head of Tibetan Buddhism. And so obviously he's a representative of the Buddhist religion, not the Christian religion. I don't know what the purpose is of the Catholic College having him speak, but it just depends on what the context is of having him speak. You know, I would, if the Dalai Lama was speaking in my town, I'd go hear him, but not because I consider him to be any kind of an expert on spiritual things. I consider him to be a man who doesn't know God and doesn't know Jesus Christ. But I'd be curious to hear what he had to say, just because I'm always curious to hear what people of other opinions have to say. I don't think Christians should be threatened by hearing people from other religions or hearing atheists speak or whatever. But I do think that if the Christian College is having him come to speak with the recommendation that the students take him seriously as a spiritual mentor or guru or something, I would certainly disagree with that. There are some people who think that Buddhism and Christianity have a great deal in common and who would like to see them somewhat merged. But there's some very serious things that Buddhism and Christianity do not have in common, and they are the things that define Christianity. One thing is Buddhism doesn't believe in God. That is, the Buddha didn't believe in God. A Buddhist might, but the Buddha did not, and Buddhism is not a theistic religion. And secondly, of course, since they don't believe in God, they don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God. They don't believe in the atonement of Christ. They believe in reincarnation and karma rather than in redemption and resurrection. These are contrary concepts. Christianity and Buddhism are literally worlds apart. The reason that some people think that they have a lot in common is there are some common ethics taught and a few common values that are taught by Buddhism and by Christianity. But then that would be true of Islam and Hinduism and Judaism. I mean, that's true of all non-Christian religions. All religions have some ethical things in common. So to find some ethical things in Buddhism that resemble some of the ethical things in Christianity is no surprise. In fact, it would be a surprise if there were none. But what makes Christianity Christian is Christ, not ethics, not some, if we only have from Jesus a good set of ethics and nothing more, then we didn't need him. We already had good ethics. Socrates and Buddha and others before Christ had taught good ethics. So, the purpose of Christianity is not to teach people how to be ethical, although ethical and moral behavior is the upshot of becoming a follower of Christ. You obviously should become a better person. But Christ came not just to teach us to be ethical, since there were plenty of teachers, even Moses and before him, who could do that and did do that. Jesus came to offer his life a ransom for many, is what he said. And Buddhism doesn't allow that. So Buddhism is an anti-Christian religion. And that doesn't mean that the Buddhists are antagonistic or hostile toward Christianity. It's just that what Buddhism affirms is not what Christianity affirms. And there's two different worldviews. So now, if a Roman Catholic college has a Buddhist spokesman come and speak, but does so that the students will be well informed about what Buddhists believe, but also with the subtext that, of course, we are not Buddhists and we don't believe what this man says, but it's interesting to hear. I mean, like I said, I would walk across the street to hear the Dalai Lama just because I'd be curious to hear what he had to say. But I wouldn't listen to him as a spiritual expert. I would listen to him as a man representing a different religion than Christianity, about which I wouldn't mind knowing a little bit more.
Okay, but I guess my question is just really quick: as Christians, should we allow someone from a different religion come in and speak on our campus or in our church? Or, from what I understand, he's just going to be speaking about the environment, peace, and global warming. It's not really going to be speaking spiritually, but who knows, you know. But biblically speaking, should we allow for somebody like that to come in and teach on our campus or in our church?
Well, I don't know why we'd have them into our church, since the church is a place for Christians to be edified, for Christians
right.
to exercise their gifts. So I couldn't imagine there'd be any reason to bring a spokesman for a different religion into our church, unless our church was conducting a debate or something like that.
Right, okay.
I mean, that'd be reasonable enough, I suppose. But I don't know that the church meeting is really where debates should be taking place, I think, at least between Christians and non-Christians. The church meeting is for the edification of the believers. And,
right.
And so that they'd become more like Jesus and be taught what he said to do. So that the church meeting is not the place for to invite the Dalai Lama, but a college, presumably a college is for education, right? At a Catholic college or any other college, let's say you said it's at a Catholic college the Dalai Lama is speaking. Well, a Catholic college would have some courses teaching Catholicism, but presumably the college also has classes teaching history and social sciences and biology and chemistry and mathematics and things like that. And there might even be a class on world religions. I would not find that objectionable. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Well, I always appreciate your commentary.
Okay, Bernard. Good talking to you.
Take care.
Okay, bye now. Yeah, and not knowing exactly in what capacity this Catholic college has invited the Dalai Lama to speak, I can't really critique it or not. I mean, if it's an exercise in comparative religions, I think that can be a legitimate subject for college, education, obviously. If it's that the Catholic college is suggesting that the Dalai Lama and the Roman Catholics are on essentially the same page, and that he's, we listen to him like we would listen to, one of our own preachers, then I'd certainly disagree with that. And there is a lot of that mentality in some of the modern church, so I don't really know what the mentality is of those who invited him there. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. We have less than 10 minutes left, and our lines are open if you'd like to give me a call. My name is Steve Gregg. You can talk to me at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. And while I wait your call, we'll hear from my friend Dwayne.
Can you have whatever you say? Can you write your own ticket with God? Is health and prosperity only a positive confession away? Is it an evidence of weak faith to be poor or sick? If these questions do not sound familiar, then you have not encountered the widely taught Word of Faith teaching. This is a doctrine of health and wealth, name it and claim it, and positive confession promoted by many of the world's largest churches and televangelists. While claiming to take their views from the Bible, the Word of Faith teachers actually promote doctrines distinctive of the metaphysical mind science cults. Because they are false, these teachings constitute an affront to the character of God and have done great harm to many who have embraced them. In a four-lecture series entitled, An Examination of the Word of Faith Teachings, Steve Gregg has thoroughly explored and refuted these claims from Scripture. An Examination of the Word of Faith Teachings, a four-lecture series, as well as hundreds of other stimulating lectures, can be downloaded in MP3 format without charge from our website, www.thenarrowpath.com. There is no charge for anything at our website. Visit us there and be amazed at all that you have been missing. That web address again is www.thenarrowpath.com.
All right, and welcome back to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg, and as Dwayne said, the website, thenarrowpath.com, has hundreds of lectures that are available for free download, MP3 files, and you should check out what's there if you are the kind of person who likes to listen to teaching. Because there's hours and hours, over, I'd say there's about 1,500 hours of lectures there that you can download for free. Let's talk to Danny from San Diego next. Danny, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question. Maybe, I don't know if you've noticed this or thought about it, or maybe you can think about it, and maybe I can hear you speak of it later, but there's two places in Matthew, I believe it's in the same chapter, I believe it's in 27, I don't have my Bible with me, where once Judas returns the money, goes back to the temple and returns the money and tells him, I've sinned against innocent blood. He mentions Jesus' blood and throws down the silver, and they tell him, what is that to us? You see to it. That's the term that they use, you see to it. And then when later on in the chapter, when Pilate is trying to release Jesus, he tells the Jews, I see, you know, this man's blood. I refuse to
I'm innocent of this man's
condemn
blood.
innocent blood. Then he tells them, you see to it. He also uses that same term, you see to it, and they said, let his blood be on us and on our children. And all that. Can you tell me what this phrase means? You see to it. What do you think that he's talking about?
First of all, I don't think that it's talking about specifically anything that has to do with the atoning blood of Christ, as we sometimes think of it. I think when they talk about innocent blood, what they mean is there was a concept in the law that if a man was murdered, that innocent blood had been shed. And Judas was acknowledging that Jesus was about to be killed innocently, and that it'd be a case of innocent blood for which Judas felt he himself was responsible. And likewise, Pilate recognized that the death of Jesus was the spilling of innocent blood and tried to absolve himself from it by washing his hands, which, of course, wouldn't do the job. Now, both the Sanhedrin speaking to Judas and Pilate, when they say, you see to it, I think that's just an expression that's saying, that's good, that's your problem. You know, that's not my problem. I'm not going to take responsibility for this, what you did. In the case of Judas, they're saying, what you did is your problem, not ours, which, of course, is not true. It was theirs as well as his, because they were the ones promoting the death of Jesus. And likewise, Pilate, when he said, you guys see to it, he's basically trying to pass off the responsibility of Jesus' crucifixion onto the Jews and tell them to attend to it themselves. But they wouldn't accept that. They said, no, we need, you know, you to condemn him. So Pilate washed his hands and said, I'm innocent of this man's blood. Anyway, they are expressions that are, you know, ancient Middle Eastern expressions, as many are found in the Bible. And I don't think there's anything extremely profound in the expression you see to it, except that the persons who are saying that in these cases are essentially saying, you take responsibility for that, not me. Appreciate your call. Stephen from Los Angeles, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Yeah, hi. I have just a brief question. You know, I know that the Bible, you read in the Bible that we all have a calling, right? You know, God has called everyone for a specific purpose for the edification in the building of the church. My question for you is, how do you know? I mean, you know, sometimes God puts things on our heart. How do I know it's really God and not me just wanting to do it? You know, I want to know how to find that calling that God has for each and every one of us.
Well, there's three things I would suggest. One is, first of all, what do you feel a burning desire to do for God? That's the first question. Now, if there's some specific thing you feel this desire to do, there is a possibility that this is your calling, but that should be checked out in a couple of ways. One would be, do you have the ability to do it? That is, has God given you the gifts that are requisite for that activity? Do you have I'm trying to think of the word. Just, do you have the spiritual gifts, I guess is the simplest way to say it. Do you have the spiritual gifts to do the thing that you feel like you're called to do? And then the third thing would be, is there an open door for you to do that? Has God, arranged something that allows you to exercise that calling that you think you have? Now, if you have only the first thing, that is a burning desire to do something, it may be that you just have to wait on God to see if he gives you the gifts for it and opens the doors for it. If he does not, then what you desire to do may not be God's call on your life, because it seems that whatever God really calls you to do, he'll also place you in the body of Christ and give you the equipment necessary to do it. I'd like to talk to you more about that personally, about what you feel your calling is, and I could give some suggestions, except that the music playing tells us that we are just out of time, and that happens awfully quick on this morning show, which is only a half hour. We have an afternoon show also you can hear on the internet from our website, The Narrow Path. It's an hour long, and you can call in on that too, thenarrowpath.com. We are a listener-supported ministry. We buy the time on the radio stations for a lot of money, and the money comes from listeners. If you'd like to help us pay the bills and keep us on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path at the address you'll find at our website, or just donate from there, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us.